Welcome to Free and Direct, a literary inclined podcast from the publishers of Indirect Books. Can art help overcome our fear of death? Can we make art without knowing death? These questions animate Talbot in the Fall, a comedy, in parentheses, with support. Charlie Talbot is a creative writing student. Her father, John, a driver on the London Underground, has been introducing her to the words and music of the legendary cult rock group The Fall. While John awaits the results of an ominous biopsy, Charlie spends the week at a writing retreat in Norfolk, working on everything but her final year project. Indirect Books' first full-length project, Talbot and the Fall, will be Michael Naith's fourth novel, a raucous and insightful meditation on life, death, art, and legacy. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Free and Direct. I'm your host, Jessica Denzer, and I'm joined here today with my co-host and co-publisher from Indirect Books, Dan White. And today we are really excited to be talking to Michael Naith, British author and academic. His first novel, La Rochelle, was published in 2010 with Root Publishing and was shortlisted for the James Tait Prize in 2011. His second novel, British Story, was also published by Root in 2014, and his third novel, The Treatment, was published by Kirkus River Run in 2020. Naith's fiction and articles have also appeared in Stand, New Welsh Review, Critical Quarterly, and anthologies. Extracts from British Story were translated into Spanish out of Argonauta 3, 2016. As an academic, he specializes in creative writing, modernism, Shakespeare, and the Renaissance. And we are very excited to announce that Michael will be publishing his fourth book with us at Indirect Books, titled Talbot in the Fall, a Comedy, with support, out in 2026. So without further ado, welcome Michael. Hello, Dan. And Michael, we're really excited that you're here today to talk about Talbot, amongst other things. So hello, and thank you for being here.
Good evening. Good evening, Indirect Books. Hello, Dan. Hello, Jessica.
So tell us a little bit, as our introduction hinted towards, you have such a sort of varied background in writing, literary background. So can you tell us a little bit about, your roots in literature, how you first got interested and then obviously you're spanning for three novels and of course a fourth novel on the way, and a little bit about kind of where you come from in the literary sense.
Yes, well, I did a PhD after my first degree, which I think in a way it was a way of putting off starting a novel. And then after the PhD, I began, and this is going back a long way, I began a novel, which was eventually published as British Story. But as a matter of fact, I began a version of that well over 20 years before it was published. Then as another sort of eccentricity, if you like, or is it a perversity? After the PhD, which was in modernist studies, I decided to start researching the Renaissance and Shakespeare particularly, which is not the sort of thing which is done, because when you specialize in a PhD, then you're expected to make a career in the specialist area, which is exactly what I didn't do. I've published work on Wyndham Lewis, who I wrote the PhD on anyway, but I became very, very interested. It was in fact Lewis who led me with one of his observations on comic character into Falstaff. So then I went sideways into Shakespeare studies for quite a long time and began teaching Shakespeare in universities as well. And I spent a long time preparing a book on Falstaff, which sort of wasn't getting anywhere. So then I condensed that book into an essay, and that again didn't get anywhere. And eventually, by an act of supreme reduction and concentration, all that research found its way into the novel British Story. So the novel I was trying to dodge writing, I had to write anyway to get the research out in.
How have you found this sort of mixture of different, there's different languages, right? So the modernist sort of And I don't just mean like the way we talk about modernism, but, you know, the use of language is so different in modernism versus, you know, instead of Shakespearean, you know, Shakespeare and, you know, Wyndham Lewis or Joyce or whomever. So, and it seems to me, you know, across all your novels, including, of course, Tablet, like there is this play, this, you know, this cacophony of language and voice. Do you think that's sort of directly kind of, you know, a lineage or?
Well, the problem is you can identify it as one. But I think between ourselves, I think writers are a bit too handy at identifying where they come from in terms of influence. Now I know anyway that you're also interested, you and Jessica, in the idea of ancestry, which I think is in a way a more interesting idea, because for any influencers a writer indicates firmly as being the ones that have made their work what it is, it seems to me there's quite likely a great sort of sunken or half buried massive reading experience which might go back a long way in life, even into childhood, which is exerting a pressure that the writer doesn't necessarily recognize. So that, and I read masses of stuff as a kid. I read comics, horror comics, war comics, crime fiction, horror fiction, history, I read books of history, I read books about chemistry as well. So that who can confidently say this is what makes the writing the way it is without, if you like, regard for what else has been read and so thoroughly digested in the way in which a child or a teenager digests work, that it's been very, very successfully taken into the imaginative system, and you can no longer indicate the effect it's had on you, but it's working there somehow. I mean, I think in one of the conversations, I think it was the conversation I did with L'Esprit, I made a great, perhaps from your point of view, rather tiresome list of things I'd read as a kid and as a teenager as well. And I think it's important to recognize, to acknowledge that there's all that there, as well as being able to say, well, yes, modernism formed my work, but also a great feeling of affinity for the writing of the late 16th, early 17th centuries, particularly the prose of that period. I mean, I can talk about things like that, but is that all there is, really? You know, I think there's more to it than that.
It's so interesting that you say that, Michael, because I was just thinking very recently this period of time that you have, I feel, really that begins in your early teens, like your preteens, right, all the way up until your 20s, where, I mean, I think we'd all like to consider ourselves now ferocious readers, but there's just something about that energy of reading that's happening at that particular period of time where you're just almost reading anything you can get your hands on, and you're digesting it so quickly. And so it's interesting to kind of think about that aspect of ancestry, right? All of the things that just kind of are consumed in that particular period of time that then essentially inform what is much more, like what you think is much more crafted and you think is much more intentional later on in life, where you're, you know, you're pointing to certain books that you're reading during that, you know, the crafting and the composition of the novel. And sometimes we forget all those things that we just completely devoured, right, during this particular period of time in our lives, which is such an informative period, right, that teens into 20s period.
Well, quite, yeah, and you're filling yourself with language, and indiscriminately and in an unguided way, because you're reading what you fancy and what you fall upon or discover or find at that period, at that age as well. And there's a great importance, there's a great creative importance, I think, particularly to people who become writers and all that early reading. And it makes it doesn't have to struggle to make an impression on you. Whereas there's quite often a contest between yourself and what you read later on, as your standards and critical tastes have developed. Am I impressed by this? Why? Do I find it difficult? But I model myself on this, and so forth. Yes.
Yeah, it reminds me, I had this copy of Waiting for Godot in high school that I ferociously, like, made all these notes about, like, trying to find, like, meaning in the language and, like, understanding, like, the kind of general, I mean, Dan and I were just recently talking about this myth of central meaning, right? But as a teenager, right, I was, like, you know, scouring over the pages, like, making, like, notes in the margins, like, what does this mean? What does this word mean? What does this line mean? And while, as you know, a much more informed person when it comes to especially Beckett, right? Now I know, I understand how ridiculous that is, but it's also just like, it was this like extreme study in language, right? Like, even if the kind of the larger concepts of absurdism are lost on like a 16-year-old searching for meaning, right? The language and the structure and all of the things that I'm inevitably studying in that moment, right, are coming into play much later in this kind of this stage of craft and kind of intentional intellectualism.
Quite, yeah. I mean, can I just give another example?
Yeah, absolutely.
But I mean, I read Kafka, The Trial, as a teenager, and I didn't reread it again for a long time. In fact, I didn't reread it again for maybe the better part of 30 years, and I happened to be rereading it again because I'd picked it as a class text for a creative class. But during that period of not having read it, I'd had a very powerful dream, and this is well over 20 years after reading The Trial. The dream was so powerful, I had to write it down as a story as soon as I had time. And it was published as a story called A Modern Adventure, which is one of the stories I've written, which I'm most pleased with. Then a few years after that, when I gave Kafka to the class, The Trial, when I came to the chapter about the visit to the painter Titorelli, I think it's chapter 7 or 8 in the trial, I realized where that dream had come from. Well over 25 years after reading the book the first time. So it had lodged within and shut the cupboard door, if you like, that experience of reading Kafka as a teenager. But on other occasions, one simply doesn't recognize the source, but it's still working. The effect of the early reading is working on you. There's one more thing. Can I?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, I did the PhD on Wyndham Lewis. Now, Lewis is a very, very considerable stylist. A remarkable prose stylist. But when I was trying to write prose fiction not long after finishing a PhD, I found that I was copying Lewis's style, but in a highly mannered and perhaps even slightly sort of twee kind of fashion. So it took quite a while to get rid of a strong influence of that kind before I could write for myself as well. So this is a writer for whom I had very, very high esteem, but it was blocking my own creative progress for a period anyway, having studied Lewis. The country night was clear and chill. On the way to the barn, they stopped to look at stars. Lloyd knew the names of constellations. Beside them was a building which he knew was a woodshed. Charlie wondered if he knew what she might do with him in the little cottage where he was lodged on his own. In the village hall, she'd sat on him, looked in his eyes, kissed him, removed herself quickly, before there was time for his reaction to become a matter of record, announcing she was off to the barn for the salon. That he rose and came with her wasn't necessarily a sign of love. She had to face this. He might be thinking he was safer from her up there among the others. Nonetheless, looking at stars together was romantic, wasn't it? Even if he seemed so interested in those tiny fires, he forgot to put his arm around her. In the barn, they'd lit two log stoves. The thing was well underway with wine and beer. And Charlie was recollecting she'd left her bottle of gin in the village hall when she checked Pretty making faces. So they were pals again. She could hardly run back out to get it, having just strolled in with Lloyd. Besides, producing a bottle of hard spirits wasn't a good look when others were sitting on rugs, sipping red ever so slowly and chewing Paloma's tortilla. And she didn't even have anything to read out. Doc Todd would notice in that way of his, which she could never tell the meaning of. She wished she had some work, like Vicky Thorndike, who's now giving them her 17th century thing about the student going to Oxford and the five girls dancing in a meadow who taunted him. They were all spellbound how she managed the voice at the time, like in the description of a red-windowed alehouse at Leamington, where the student and his servant stopped on their journey, and their talk there with the hostess, with a mort, with a deerhound, and with a soldier who recruited musicians for the Continental Wars. Don's praising her like Billy O. Doc Todd said it was better than Hilary Mantel, Vicky was like, oh, she was just taking dictation at end of day. But Charlie knew that was Yorkshire modesty. What she had was the art to tune into the past, like it was still transmitting live.
That was Michael Naith reading from his upcoming novel, Talbot in the Fall.
Well, that's great. Thank you, Michael. That's I love that. It's probably my favorite chapter of the book. But and so, you know, we can have a lot to say. And I'm you know, maybe one thing, I'll just sort of jump off where we left off. And Michael, you sort of maybe sort of take this, you know, and run with it maybe. But I'm one thing that I'm curious about with this book is the way that, so Charlie and her father John, right, you know, kind of on the one hand, Charlie's looking forward, right, and so she's young, she's, you know, 19, 20, 21, whatever she is, she's a university student, she's at this creative writing retreat for a week, she's trying to write her final project, you know, her novel project, or her, you know, her creative project, whatever, and she's thinking about art, and she's thinking about this music of the band The Fall, which I know we'll come on to do. And she's thinking about how to create. She's here with Vicky, and she's Paloma, and she's got these other friends of hers that are writing, and she's sort of got this love interest with Lloyd, who's, you know, and it's maybe the first time some of this, or one of the first times some of this has happened, and everything's sort of forward facing, and she's sort of like sort of a vessel sort of soaking up life. I think, Jessica, you earlier mentioned like kind of like a sponge, you know, when we're younger readers. And John, you know, her father, who of course is sort of our impetus, our sort of inciting incident, if you want to put it in those terms, or just our inaugural event of the book narratively, is, you know, John's test, you know, for this biopsy. And, you know, and we're waiting, you know, throughout the book to see if there's if it's malignant, and, you know, it, you know, obviously it sort of portends, but he's getting older and potentially, you know, he'll have a, you know, sort of a prognosis that maybe wouldn't be super long, you know, if you know, depending on the, as well as the test. So, and he's thinking backward, right? He's thinking about the music of the fall. He's thinking about, you know, he goes to the funeral with his old friend from childhood, and he's, you know, and so anyway, that's sort of a long setup to get into this. One thing that really animates this book, and I know we have a lot of the things that we think about in this book, but is that sort of looking forward and looking backward thing. Anyway, I'm kind of interested if you want to sort of speak on that, and again, sort of feel free to, you know, expand a little bit on the book writ large. But that was something that really interested me about sort of creation and where we sort of take these things that the three of us have talked about in the first portion here of our conversation about what we take from life. And the book really seems to want to play with that, both in its composition and then sort of what it sort of says as well.
So, well, with Charlie, the question is, how do you become creative? And what Charlie's colleagues in the creative writing cohort, the other young women are all doing very well with their projects. Charlie's getting nowhere with hers. And not for want of trying. She's had a number of false starts. But there's something which is just beyond her grasp at the start of the book, which becomes nearer and nearer to her grasp as the book develops, which is the thing you need to become creative for certain people. Now, of course, people might have a talent for writing, but how do you realize the talent? How do you set about turning it into words and into fiction, in Charlie's case, into something solid? Or maybe it's a kind of auto-fiction, actually, that Charlie ends up writing. I think she does, as a matter of fact, when she finally realizes what she needs to do. But what she needs is... And this is what she learns from The Fall. She needs a standpoint. Now, by this, we mean something that's a position that's not being blown around by fashion and ideology and current political habits and tastes. It's a being able to stand still in order to create, rather than moving with the flow, if you like. And moving with the flow suits some writers, but for others, it doesn't. And what Charlie needs is to be able to find where she stands, so as to be able to create. Now, the pressure of time is part of this. She's got, everybody else is well ahead with their finals project. She's barely started hers. When she discovers that her father is waiting 7 days for a biopsy result, then the pressure of that time gets her going as well. But it's something she's learned from her father's introduction to her of the music of the fall, is that ordinary life can be an admirable material for art if you wild it in a certain way. Also that repetition can be an admirable and effective technique in art, but also that you need a standpoint. You need to know where you are in relation to your material before you can effectively create. These are some of Charlie's lessons.
Yeah, I think that really comes through in the book. And I think that the sort of the ways that, and one thing I like about the book, and we could get into the sort of narration, but, you know, is how the sort of reader, you know, the reader really sort of is immersed in that feeling when we're in the Charlie chapters, right? And it, you know, it's not this sort of, it's kind of didactic sort of discussion about it. It's really just a sort of like feeling, just sort of feeling about it, right? And so I guess, you know, and so you mentioned in your conversation there is The Fall and the band The Fall, and of course the full title of the book, right? Talbot and The Fall, right? A Comedy with Support. And so as the book goes along, you know, sort of one of the narrative elements that we have in a bit of the fictive past and the fictive present is, you know, is Charlie being introduced by her father specifically, you know, to this band. So do you want to just talk a little bit about, you know, why did you want to write a band about The Fall? You know, and sort of, I know you have a long history with them, so you just kind of want to talk a little bit about, you know, where this book kind of emanated from specifically in its relationship to that band.
Well, I heard The Fall over 40 years ago, the first time. Something that's interesting about this group is that it can take a long time to acquire a taste for the music and words. But if one acquires that, it tends to become a lifelong taste, but more than a taste, really. It turns into something like, I hope this doesn't sound like an exaggeration, it turns into something like an artistic faith, really. That a certain artistic phenomenon, The Fall, can carry on for so long and to a lot of people be kind of off-putting or ugly or impossible to listen to, so that it's the quality in an artist that allows them to back themselves even when the world seems against them. Can I read out a little passage that means a lot to me? This is from, I don't know if you know about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a Protestant pastor who was imprisoned by the Nazis, in fact hanged 2 days before the war, Second World War ended. But he wrote this from, he was quite a considerable scholar as well. He wrote this, these words while he was in prison, 9th of March. His prison letters are wonderful documents, 9th of March, 1944. And he's talking about a quality called hilaritas. And he's referring to certain composers and painters and theologians and writers who have this quality. Now, this is what Bonhoeffer writes. Hilaritas I might describe as confidence in their own work, boldness and defiance of the world and of popular opinion, a steadfast certainty that in their own work they are showing the world something good, even if the world doesn't like it, and a high-spirited self-confidence. So steadfast certainty that in their own work they're showing the world something good, even if the world doesn't like it, and a high-spirited self-confidence. This, to me, is a particularly sort of sovereign or prized quality. And I find it in The Fall. I find it in another artist that I've mentioned as being an inspiration to me, Orson Welles, in his filmmaking. I found it in the work of Wyndham Lewis as well. It's the preparedness, the ability to back yourself against opposition. Against opposition in taste, opposition in the market, opposition here, there, everywhere, if you will. It's the ability, if you like, to stand outside the castle walls that fortify the marketplace of average culture and blow and blow until you've knocked those walls down. It's to lay siege, yes, from outside, often with depleted resources. And it's something of this sort that Charlie's having to learn as well. Now, the other point, about The Fall is that to the father, who's had no university education, there's an education coming from The Fall. The Fall is a kind of alternative university, if you like. And there's been some interesting work done on this issue. I don't know if you, this is a book to to note, it's called Excavate, The Wonderful and Frightening World of the Fall, edited by Tessa Norton and Bob Stanley's Faber two or three years ago. And Tessa Norton, one of the two editors, she writes about an essay in this collection called Paperback Shamanism, and a very, very good essay, I think, as well. And she's making the sort of point that I'm trying to develop in Talbot about the fall being an irregular and alternative form of education for people rather than the set institutional education you get from university. Now, in Britain, and I'm not sure if it can be compared directly to the US, there was at one time a considerable tradition of autodidacticism, particularly in industrial working class areas, late to 19th century, perhaps first half of the 20th century. This is a matter of self-teaching and attendance at irregular lectures as well, rather than institutional education at the university. Mark E. Smith of The Fall is really an autodidact, not a university man himself. But I've got an image Charlie fancies in the book of Mark Smith coming in from school, lying on the floor in his blazer, reading the Encyclopedia Britannica and reading the article on time, and coming to St. Augustine, the Confessions, chapter 12, I think it is, of that great work. I know what time is until you ask me, and then I'm not so sure. And this actually finds its way into a Fall lyric. So I've created that image of him studying it just on the basis of a lyric. But yes, to teach oneself rather than be taught, I think, is an interesting thing, because autodidacticism, it has its limits, of course, but it's an adventure, and it's an act of adventure in learning, a bit like the sort of reading we were talking about as children and young adults that we do. Whereas university education, well, of course, it has its merits, but it's managed. That's the thing. And the student, the university student, is in a degree a passive customer, whereas the autodidact is going out to find things for themselves, really, and following their curiosities and cross-referencing and going where the adventure of learning takes them, if you will. Falstaff, Bardolph, am I not fallen away vilely since this last action? Do I not bait? Do I not dwindle? Why, my skin hangs about me like an old lady's loose gown. I am withered like an old apple chon. Well, I'll repent, and that suddenly, while I am in some liking. I shall be out of heart shortly, and then I shall have no strength to repent. And I have not forgotten what the inside of a church is made of. I'm a peppercorn, a brewer's horse. The inside of a church. Company, villainous company, hath been the spoil of me.
That was Michael Naith reading for the part of Falstaff in Shakespeare's Henry IV, Part 1, Act 3, Scene 3. Thank you, Michael. That was really lovely. I'm so glad that you brought Falstaff here with you today.
I love that passage, and I think of the sort of, you know, the Church of the Fall too, right? We can think about that. But do you want to talk a little bit, Michael, just sort of give us a little bit of an overview of kind of why you wanted to bring out this section, this play, and also maybe this character, as Jessica mentions, and this particular maybe passage as well, in relation to our conversation today?
I said that Wyndham Lewis led me on to Falstaff, and there's a wonderful essay by Lewis called Inferior Religions, about 1917, reprinted 1927. And in that, Lewis thought a good deal about comedy and laughter, a great deal about comedy and laughter. He's one of the great critical thinkers and practitioners as well in these matters, comedy and laughter. But Lewis writes in that essay something like, I don't have it with me, a comic type is a failure of a considerable energy. And he mentions Falstaff in the same breath. And what he seems to be suggesting there is that the comic type, whether it's a type in the sense of typical or type in the sense of outstanding, the outstanding model, it's sort of self-standardizing, if you like. It copies itself. So I went to look at the Henry IV plays again when I'd read that. And I thought to myself, no, there's a mistake here. I began looking intently for instances of what I thought was a dramatic self-consciousness in Falstaff. A self-consciousness that's not allowed to express itself because of what he socially or publicly is. So company, villainous company, hath been the spoil of me. He performs himself for social success, for popularity, so that it gets to the point where there's a tradition in criticism. It's not the only criticism of Falstaff that exists. There's a tradition in criticism that says this is the exemplar of the character who lives for the moment and in search of enjoyment. Yes, time doesn't matter to him. Mortality doesn't matter. He in Freudian terms, if you will, he's got rid of the superego entirely, right? Or he's something like Nietzsche's Übermensch. He's utterly self-affirming. There's nothing behind the self that you get. I think this is a mistake. I think that there are most fascinating instances or glimpses of self-consciousness in Falstaff that gets suppressed or repressed again and again because of the demands of social being, because of the demands of the milieu, also because people want him to be funny rather than melancholy, and also because, and this is an old thing, he's often represented as the tempter, as the Satan to Hal. But as a matter of fact, we can look at this quite dialectically, if you will. It's Hal who tempts Falstaff to be the Falstaff that everybody wants to be. Because the price Falstaff will pay if he stops being the way people want to be, he'll be hanged because of robberies and other crimes as well. He talks about hanging a good deal in the early part, in the early scenes of Henry IV, Part One. The prince is a royal patron; he's saving him from the gallows on the condition that Falstaff keeps amusing him. That's another way of reading it. So that my feeling is that this huge fat knight, he's also got a huge other self, a huge other area of being that he keeps in reserve, yes, or behind the arras, if you like. There's much more to him than meets the eye or the ear. And I think this study of self-consciousness in Falstaff, it's a kind of model, it's a model for Shakespeare. I think there's no Hamlet without Falstaff. It's a model for later writers as well. And the English novel, and I'm not talking about the French or Spanish or Russian novel, but the English novel owes a very, very great deal to Shakespeare. Shakespeare is one of the forming influences on the English novel in the 18th century and into the early 19th century as well. Look at people like Sterne or Sir Walter Scott, for example, or Fielding as well. But as a model of self-consciousness, a self-consciousness that's not allowed to be in the world. This is what fascinated me about Falstaff. He has to keep holding himself back from what he also is. That was my interest in the character anyway. And it's taught later writers a good deal about self-consciousness and character. I also wanted to find out whether you could have a comic protagonist who is as profound a being as protagonists in tragedies, for example. I think in Falstaff's case, you've got that and more. "I'm melancholy," says Falstaff in the first scene he's presented in. "No, you aren't," says the prince. They make jokes about it, and Falstaff is eager to make jokes, but he said he was melancholy. Did he say he's melancholy because he wasn't, or because he was, but he's not allowed to say any more about it? The first words of Falstaff, as he enters with Hal, Henry IV, Part One, Act One, Scene Two, is, "Now, Hal, what time of day is it, lad?" He asks the time, and there's a great flood of mockery from the prince. "Why are you so concerned about the time? You just live for the moment. All you want to do is enjoy yourself." And Falstaff falls in with this version of himself, but he asked the question, and it could have gone another way. What is it to be worried about the time? Well, it's that within a sort of period, Protestant culture, it's about the time for repentance and contrition. It's also about the time of death as well. He's an old fat man in poor health. He's an alcoholic as well. He thinks about death a good deal, but the prince won't let him think about death because the prince has got his life in his hands. But the question about time is possibly a question about mortality. He's not allowed to ask it. He's swatted aside when he asks it. "You're not bothered about that sort of thing." Well, I am. "No, you're not." And he's not allowed to be. But it's there. And Shakespeare's put it there. Has Shakespeare put it there just as a joke opportunity or as something else as well? That's the question.
Well, I think Falstaff, the relationship between Falstaff and Hal is such a Shakespearean relationship, especially, you know, in these close readings of Shakespeare. I mean, you know, we could talk about the history plays, or you could talk about Hamlet, but I think one of the things that's really has always kind of struck me about that relationship is kind of the projection that is happening between Hal and Falstaff, because Hal's desire to be this thing that he eventually will not be, right? Like he eventually has to kind of saddle up and be the king that he's eventually going to become, right? And so the desire to be this other thing, this person who doesn't care about time, this person who doesn't care about power, who doesn't care about having to be responsible for anything or anyone, is so present in him, and so much of his treatment of Falstaff often has felt to me like a projection of that person. Like, if I can keep Falstaff alive in this place, then I can be in this place, or I can maintain myself in this space. And not only is that kind of this, it creates an interesting dynamic between the two, and therefore does everything that you're talking about, which denies this other self to Falstaff, but also that denial is so related to other thematics in Shakespeare, where we have these subtle moments in which the monarchy or those who are in power are very much objectifying other characters for their own ends, whether it's because they want to maintain the party boy Hal version of themselves, or for they want to maintain this image of the, you know, victimized father and the like noble king over the, you know, villainous mother and the villainous you know, uncle, or however you're kind of thinking about these, to kind of merge both Falstaff and Hamlet together. But in that language, right, the utilization of that language, kind of the switching of projection and tone, there's so much material, right? Like, that's one of the beauties of Shakespeare, is he can say something so quick and so short that's like so loaded, right? Like, you know, your students will complain, oh, why do I have to read this long monologue? And I'm like, it's actually a really short play, right? Like, if you actually really think about it. And so many things are being said so briefly, and oftentimes the heavier things are the more brief. And especially that thing you said about time, it also reminds me of Charlie, right? And everything you were saying about kind of the time of the, you know, the project, the time of the burgeoning pressure of the ingenue, right? This idea of the young ingenue that has to, you know, come out of the university like brilliant. And that pressure so often then leads to exactly what we're talking about, right? This idea of the denial of the other self, right? Or the projection of desire, right, onto others. But really what it is exactly what you said. It's this fear, right? This fear of failure, right? Which is really this larger conversation of this fear of mortality, right? That there isn't enough time to do these things that we think from the external world that we are supposed to do.
Brilliant.
And that's how we start Talbot, right? Talbot opens, you know, is it a year after Mark Smith's death? Right?
It's 2-3 months, as a matter of fact.
2-3 months, right. Yeah. So everything just saying. And then obviously we've got that death sort of, you know, lingering over us, you know, and we've got, and then we've obviously got John, you know, his question about his diagnosis, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's also, Talbot is the obituary for Mark Smith, which I haven't seen written anywhere. So it's a novel length obituary. And it's taking place, as I say, 2 or 3 months after the death of Marky Smith, Captain, as we call him. Yeah, the 7 days structure is sort of narratively critical. He's got 7 days to get something done to make meaning of his life. This is the pressure of mortality on John Talbot. What is he going to do? He's got options. Which one is he going to follow? As a matter of fact, he finds his daughter so possibly involved in a serious crime, which it turns out she's had nothing to do with. But he finds she's possibly involved in such a way that becomes the meaning of the week, if you will, before he gets the result.
I keep thinking as we talk about time, right, and this idea of the pressure that, you know, the pressure of mortality, right, both in John and then also kind of in the larger conversation about the framing of obituary, right, and the framing of death as kind of the larger conversation, right, within the novel. about this idea we were discussing earlier about the ways in which our creative voice or our understanding of ourselves, our identities as writers, is actually so much more of a slower process, right? Like, it is actually such a slow process. Of course, it's presented, going back to this idea of the ingenue, right? Like, it's presented to us as if it's something that, you know, we immediately hone within this very specific time period of our lives, and that, like, if that talent isn't immediately present, like, by 22 or 21 right out of university, then there is nothing, right? Which, you know, for Charlie is kind of the larger dilemma, right? Like, all of her friends have already started, all of her cohort has already started on their larger projects, like, they're getting closer to the end, and she feels, like, stifled.
What's more, I mean, it's about death and about art, is Talbot. It's about the two things. Can art save us from the fear of death? And this becomes a matter of most crucial or urgent importance to Charlie. If she can write, then the fear of her own father's death, particularly if she can write about a father, that fear will be controlled or allayed, if you will. So it's a critical 7-day period for the father because of the test result, but it's a critical 7 days for her as well, because she's got to find a way of making a beginning, if not necessarily of finishing the thing, so that she knows she can do it. Yes? Can art save us from the fear of death? That's one of the guiding questions of the book.
This idea of mortality and kind of this constant thematic mentioning of the potential ending of life, like this, like the limitedness of life that you're kind of so wonderfully pointing out,
makes me think about how when a death occurs, not our death, but a death occurs outside of ourselves, that a kind of self of ourselves die also. So parts of ourselves are gone, right? That can no longer be enacted with that person or that experience, right? Whether it is your favorite musician or your favorite writer or your father. And so in thinking about kind of how we not only mourn the people that we loved who die, but also mourn a self of ours that has died, right?
Yeah.
And to bring that back to Charlie, the question becomes, what's at stake?
Beyond staving off death, how do you kind of think about, or how does art become a way to both stave off mortality, but also to mourn aspects of ourselves, aspects of our own lives that are potentially going to be gone, or deaths of the self that happen. I mean, and, you know, we can think about this also, you know, like in this very kind of extreme meta way, right? Like also the novel in of itself arguably has been, referred to as kind of an act of death, right? Like the end of a novel is kind of an act of dying.
Yeah, so Benjamin says this, yeah. The storyteller, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Can I just ask you something,
yeah.
Jessica? It's I think you've got a lot invested in the death of Ophelia, yes? Because I was reading your piece in the anthology.
Oh, yeah, Bodies Full of River, yeah.
Yeah. What is, I mean, it's a very, very powerful piece as well. I thought it was terrific, but what is your... Is it an emotional investment or an artistic one in that death by drowning?
Yeah, I mean, that essay is kind of asking similar questions, right? Like, more so, I would say, I mean, and for the listeners who don't know what I'm talking about, this is an essay that I wrote called The Bodies Fill the River, that is kind of an auto-theory essay.
Which is the one I'm referring to. I was reading it the other night, yeah.
Well, thank you for reading it. I mean, I think that essay is asking various aspects about death, right, and kind of the larger ways in which we handle death. Ophelia, to me, feels like, in many ways, like a utility in the play, right? Like she kind of functions as a utility to explore the multiplicity of death that is ultimately going to end the play, and to, in fact, kind of perform and enact death. It's almost like a practice of death before the actual main event where everybody dies, basically, within the play. But I think particularly in that instance, kind of thinking about ways in which, and I think this is also related to Falstaff, ways in which various characters in Shakespeare, and therefore various characters in our lives, right? I mean, I think we all do this to an extent. But especially in Shakespeare, oftentimes it's framed within this conversation of structures of power, various ways in which individuals become, utility to kind of practice and enact deaths before they actually occur. And in that way, those characters who are functioning as utility do become kind of objects of death, right? And they kind of become objects of the character's own internal fantasies, internal desires, and fears that they can kind of project onto these more vulnerable characters, you know? So, I mean, in relation to Hamlet, Ophelia is arguably one of the most vulnerable characters in the play, right? Falstaff is obviously an extremely vulnerable character. And they begin to carry kind of this, the burden of fantastical death reenactment over and over again. To the point with Ophelia, she ultimately dies. Like, she is, in fact, dead first before Hamlet and before that kind of larger scene. So, I mean, there's a lot I can say about that as well. Like, the essay does take a lot of turns there. But I think in relation to this conversation and what I was thinking about in that, a lot of it is about the utility, right? Kind of the objectification and utility of these more vulnerable characters.
Well, I love the bit about your narrator making the students look up the footnotes on flowers. As well, it's a wonderful detail there.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Yeah. I nag them, like, as you said. I also nag my students for the things that are important to me.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, death's an art. I mean, it's a crude enough formula, if you like. The successful work of art, the artist hopes, is A, going to be a gift of their reality to the world, and B, it's a thing that one hopes will last longer than the living person who's made it as well, and last longer than the loved people or other people who are recorded in it will have in their lifetimes also. Is to make something that will last. It's got the potential to last, yes?
Yeah.
And it's no more and perhaps no less. Perhaps no more than that, but no less than that either. And that's a significant thing. And I think it takes a maturity to accept that it's not the same as, if you like, spiritual immortality. It's an immortality of a material kind, of a worlded kind, if you will.
It's also just like that conversation about active participation, which I think, to bring back to your question about bodies, the essay Bodies, is this conversation about active participation in your own mortality, right? Like, recognizing that it doesn't have to be a passive act, that there can be some kind of choice or attempted action within that death. Whether it's something that's going to happen years from now or it's something that's going to happen 7 days, that the act of creating in some shape or form functions as a way to participate in it, right? Like, not just to immortalize, but to participate in the ways in which both life and death occur.
And one thing that this sort of conversation makes me think of, back to Talbot a little bit, Michael, is it makes me sort of think a little bit when Charlie is sitting towards the end of the book and she's really, and you know, we really has to get down to it with her final project. And she wonders, right, Michael, she wonders if she can write about some of these things with her father without experiencing her father's death, right? Like, really, like, and can she write if John lives? And that's a question that she sort of is, you know, and there's obviously all sorts of guilt and she's very distraught by that thinking, I think, right? And there's a representational quality to that question. How can we sort of tell stories? What do we have to experience? This goes all the way back to, I think, the beginning of our conversation, but what do we have to experience in order to tell these stories? You know, where can we sort of let the muse sort of do the thing for us? But I think it's such an interesting, you know, this sort of orbiting of death and art and you know, what, you know, to some extent, there's a limit on what you can experience in the death, right, before you can write about it, if you are still able to write about it after the end of it, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's because her colleagues, Vicky and Paloma, have written about dead ancestors that Charlie has this. It's a black flash of resentment. If my father died, I could write his life. But I love him. I love him more than I want to be a writer, so I'll never be a writer. It's a genuine dilemma and crux. It's that it leads to going to look for death on the island. That it all happens in the chapter we were looking at the beginning. But I think what she settles with is that death is sort of close at hand. John Updike once said, "The old man is in range in this book." Death is sort of walking the room like a modest celebrity. That's an image we use in Talbot. Perhaps even too shy to come up to you, but sooner or later he'll come up to you. But she has to settle with the fact that death is close enough for it to be the opportunity for her to become the writer she could be. And that's the compromise she has to make.
I think there's something we should mention here. All this talk of death and mortality is that the book is called Talbot and the Fall, a comedy with support. And it just reminds me that it's a comedy, right? That this book is a comedy, that it's a funny book. And it's related to what we were talking earlier, that the power of comedy is the ability to explore these deeply human, but sometimes deeply uncomfortable aspects of our mortal lives through laughter.
Laughter is a profoundly important force. It's not just about pleasure or enjoyment or entertainment or mockery. There's something we learn about life and being and time from laughter that we maybe can't learn elsewhere or otherwise. Something that fascinates me is the phrase to be beside oneself. And I think it's generally used only if people are weeping, but people are beside themselves with grief or beside themselves with mirth. And I like to think about the self stepping outside the self almost ecstatically when that phrase is used, either in a paroxysm of grief or of mirth as well. And that's stepping outside the self. And Georges Bataille, I don't know if you two have read Bataille, Bataille's got a very interesting remark about this, that kind of laughter actually arrests time. It frees us from the tyranny or domination of time. So that laughter is a flash of immortality in laughter as well, if you like, being beside oneself.
Thank you so much for being here today, Michael. It's been a pleasure. Talbot and the Fall, a comedy with support, will be out with Indirect Books in 2026. For more information on Michael and on Talbot and the Fall, you can go to our website at indirectbooks.org.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Jessica. It's always a pleasure talking to you both from London, UK, capital of free speech.
This has been Free and Direct, a literary inclined podcast from the publishers of Indirect Books. Readings and music mentioned in our discussion with Michael Nath today can be found on our Free and Direct podcast page at indirectbooks.org.